This is The Sporkful.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely, and because if history's taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Great show lined up for you today. Remember that if you aren't already, please do subscribe to The Sporkful podcast through the iTunes podcast app or wherever finer podcasts are distributed. We're on Facebook, on Twitter. Connect with The Sporkful in all the ways you can. Let's go ahead and jump right into it. Today's topic for mastication and rumination is restaurant eating. Valentine's Day is coming up. A lot of folks going to be going out to eat, and we have an expert in that pursuit here joining me today, Adam Platt, New York Magazine restaurant critic. Welcome to The Sporkful.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. I've been a fan of your writing for a long time. Very excited to have you here.
You're very kind.
Now, you recently made a lot of news. The New York Magazine Where to Eat 2014 issue came out, and you, your picture, your face is on the cover.
That's correct.
Which is a big deal because traditionally restaurant critics work under cover of night in anonymity.
That's correct also.
You threw water on that tradition.
The heck with it.
Why?
With me, the decision was made. It was really the idea of my editors, and they said, you know, and they eat with me all the time, and they, you know, they see this rigmarole which goes on, and I refer to it, I think, in the piece that I wrote, the little introductory piece, of sort of this kabuki dance that goes on between the restaurateurs and the critics. I have a couple of things that are problematic for me vis-a-vis disguises, and if you've seen the cover of that magazine, you know I'm quite a large person. The big sort of balloon-shaped bald head. So it's never been easy. I mean, I'm 6 foot, whatever. It's never been easy for me to disguise myself.
Do they have your picture up in some restaurants?
They got your picture, although I don't think they ever had a very good picture. And I think if you looked for me on the internet beforehand, you wouldn't really find me. I'm sort of an anonymous.
Was this the real reason, Adam, why you did this, was to get a better picture of yourself up on the walls of the restaurants?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. But the fact is that it's always been problematic.
And I think it seems like one of the things you really object to in the piece is that it's this total charade on everyone's. You're pretending to be a regular customer. They're pretending you're a regular customer. You both know that the other one's in on it, and yet you still have to go along with this ridiculous pretense.
Right. Like I say, it's a kabuki dance.
Right.
And it happens every night, and I'm a willing partner in it. So I don't know if I object strenuously to it. The point of the piece was basically, it was really more for the public.
Right. So have things changed since the piece come out? I mean, you
no.
No? Nothing's changed?
Not really. Occasionally people in restaurants will recognize me.
The customers.
The customers.
Right.
You know, the kabuki dance is still so very quite somewhat intact, I'd say. And
right.
I think that's not bad. I mean, I think the last thing a professional critic wants, I mean, you can try and give them the best food you can, but you don't, if you don't want this obtrusiveness. I mean, nobody wants it,
right.
Really. And so you don't want this sense of obtrusiveness and that, you know, sending you free stuff. And if that happens, you know, critics who, many critics who are supposedly incognito, but they know who they are, will react. It can backfire. So,
all right. Well, it's sort of like, don't you know this? You're part in the charade. You're messing up the charade. Don't send
charade,
me special stuff.
Don't send it to me.
That's
it's
right.
All normal. You already
nothing
knew,
to see here.
You already knew what I looked like. Let's just proceed as usual.
Right.
And there's another little point about the whole kabuki dance is that professional critics do not order like normal people. Professional critics order in a way that is, you know, the restaurant people will notice it. I mean, you'll order everything and they'll go, oh.
So you're saying when three people order 15 entrees,
yeah,
that
like,
tends
oh.
to get
it's
the
like,
attention of the kitchen.
It's like, oh. wait, there he is. He's 6'9". He's got a giant head. Uh-oh.
So let's segue a bit into actual restaurant eating, and I will certainly link to your piece at sporkful.com and through social media. It was a great piece of writing, as I said, and you talk at the very end of the piece about now that people know what you look like, perhaps they'll be more likely to come up to you in a restaurant, and you describe what your reaction may be, and then you end the piece saying, then you will tuck your napkin back into your collar and continue with your meal.
There you go.
Are you a napkin, collar, tuck guy? Is that always your approach?
Well, you know, at home I am. I was sort of a figure of speech. But yes, if I'm one of those kind of eaters. I have two daughters, I have a wife. They're quite petite, sort of gentle souls, and they view me as a large, sort of untrained barnyard animal in their midst. So yeah, I'm a two napkin eater. Actually.
So at a restaurant, though, it's funny because I have two daughters, but they're 3 and 8 months old, so they still think whatever I do is adorable. I'm not sure that's going to last much longer. I'm sure I'll get to them.
They'll start rolling their eyes.
Yeah. I think that the napkin collar tuck is a great move. But I actually wish we could go one step further and just make bibs, adult-sized bibs, an acceptable thing even in nice restaurants.
Bibs will be good. I mean, napkins, there are a lot of civilized people who eat with napkins. I mean, if you're wearing nice clothes, I have very sort of, you know.
But if you do a napkin collar tuck, do you get asked for a second napkin to put on your lap?
No.
So how do you protect your lap?
I don't. Well, the fact is, like, I don't really. Again, if I did the napkin tuck in restaurants all the time, it would again call attention to myself. So unless it's a steakhouse or I've already got stuff all over, it's really nice clothes. If I'm wearing nice clothes, which is not very often, I'll do the napkin tuck. But usually, I have a napkin in my lap. I'm just a normal person, but I have the soul of a napkin tucker.
Do you have a tucking technique? Because I have trouble getting it to stay in there.
Well, I think you just got to get a good heavy linen napkin. You just got to jam it down there.
And then
smooth it out occasionally.
Oh, you smooth it out because the ruffles can get in the way of arm movement.
Smooth it out occasionally. And I wear a napkin at home.
Okay.
Because I referred in this piece to my sauce stained coat. It really is sauce stained. I really got stains all over it. So, I wear napkins at home, and yeah, I just tuck it in, and it's very useful.
So before you even get into the more nitty-gritty of where you want to sit, what you want to order, the menu, et cetera, we have to get into one of the biggest issues in restaurant going, for me at least. I'm sure it's something you've given a lot of thought to, and that is scented hand soap in the bathroom.
This is the thing, okay? When I first started this job, I wrote a lot about the bathrooms.
Oh, really?
Because it was the turn of the millennium, and you had these flashy. These restaurants open less now, but you had these fancy, big. I used to call them big box restaurants. Big, glossy, glamorous, fusion-y, giant. You know, pulsating like
waterfalls and
frozen Buddhas, all that stuff. So I write about the bathrooms. Like, and my editor finally came to me and goes, you know what. Let's not write so much about bathroom. So anyway, scented hand soaps, I take whatever soap I can get. It's fine. Whatever they got in there.
But you're not concerned about the scent on your hands affecting the flavor of the food?
Oh, come on. Are you?
Well, I've actually encouraged restaurants to hire sommeliers.
Really? Is that an issue? I didn't know that was an issue. Maybe that's an issue.
It's an issue for me. Well, like if you have a strong scent of lavender on your hands, you're trying to eat a steak.
Well, sushi, well, steak, yeah.
Whatever it may be. But I think that restaurants should pair hand soaps with dishes.
Okay.
You could have like a sommelier who could wheel a cart through the restaurant, like an old-fashioned dessert cart.
Sommelier? Yeah.
And you could pick like a lavender soap to go with a ratatouille or something.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I know, well, that's sort of, that's an idea. It's a notion.
Let's jump into the real details here. You say in your piece that in the realm of restaurants, the quality and enjoyment of your dinner can vary dramatically depending on where you sit, what time of day you eat, and what you happen to order.
Correct.
So let's take those issues in order.
Okay.
Where is the best place to sit?
I tend to just let them put me wherever they put me. But it just depends on your proclivities. Now, some people like eating at the bar. Now, with a group of people, that's no good. If I'm actually with one person or by myself, I actually like eating at the bar. Not only is it because the service is very fast, but you can also gather a lot of information. Bartenders are very loquacious. You can talk about stuff with the bartenders, whereas waiters don't want to
like what
talk
for,
about
for the average person out to eat. Like, you know, what kind of information could you get from the bartender that would make you
anything, whatever?
Right.
What's the drink? The foods. I mean, it's a very how long have you been open? It's one of my personal favorite places to sit.
Right.
You don't want to sit next to the kitchen, obviously. But frankly, if they put me next to the kitchen, I think that's amusing because then I'll write about it. But I think ideally, as a diner. Of course, you have the whole Siberia concept. Now, classically, in like the sort of power restaurants, the places where people want to sit are up front so they can be seen. I actually would like to be buried in the back. I think it's private. As long as you're not near the kitchen or the bathroom, I think it's fine.
Because my mom is notorious for requesting another table. She's never satisfied with the first table that she's offered.
Yeah.
She's also convinced that as she's gotten, her and my dad have gotten older, that they don't get as good placement as they used to get, that they're pushed to the back more. Like, or when they go out with my attractive younger female cousins, then they get up right at the front. I mean, do you think there's merit to that?
They're probably not wrong about that. You know, I think she's probably very astute about that. They, you know, they're, you know, that those things happen all the time.
Right. Let's talk about the best time of day to eat. You say in the piece that your favorite time to dine is 6:30 in the evening.
Correct.
Why?
Which is, well, usually the restaurants aren't very crowded. It's much easier to get a table. And also, it's easy to get in and out. Whereas if I go at 8, the meal's longer. I won't get home until 11:30. I'll be tired. So for a middle-aged fat man with two kids at home, it's like, you know, 6:30 is sort of ideal. The service at 6:30 will be often much different than at 8:30. It'll be much, you know, there's more pressure at 8:30. It's more crowded. The waiters are more harried. But it's also more fun. I mean, there's more energy, more vibrancy.
Right.
And that you know, goes into one's impressions of a place.
But see, I actually feel like there's another good reason why eating earlier is better, which is that I don't like going to bed really full. And I like a good drink. And I would rather have some drink and food on the earlier end of the evening and then maybe go to the bar for a nightcap. As opposed to stop eating at 10 o'clock, you know, to eat until 10 o'clock at night and then try to get into bed. I mean, forget about it.
I think that's very sound thinking.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you can just like, I didn't even think of the booze. I mean, you can sit there and you can booze.
Right. And you got some food in your stomach, so you're not going to end up falling off your chair. But you get a nice little buzz. You enjoy a cocktail, some good conversation. You give time for the food to settle. Yeah. Maybe you have a cocktail that involves a spirit or a mixer that helps the food to settle.
I'm with you.
And you go to bed happy.
I mean, a lot of the you know, real food, you know, restaurant obsessed people I know, that's what they do. They like going early. It's no problem. It's the easiest time of day, and you can enjoy the food, and the service isn't harried, and like you say, you can have a bunch of drinks.
The last point in your list was what you happen to order. Let's get into ordering.
Right.
Okay. Now, when you first pick up a menu, what, you know, talk to folks out there who maybe don't go out to eat as often as you do. What are you looking for in the menu?
Well, again, I'm personally just looking to see what's on it. Okay.
That's and crazy.
I know it's weird, but I'm just looking to see what's on the menu. And, you know, it depends on your tastes, but certain menus are just written beautifully. They're written, and again, we don't live in a flowery restaurant age. We live in a sort of, I wouldn't call it puritanical, but it's a very pared down.
Yeah, sometimes they'll just list ingredients without listing even the cooking method.
They do that. There is that. There's overspare, just the ingredients, like if you go to Kraft or
that something.
That I
find annoying.
It can be annoying.
It's just like, it just says chicken, and then it says beets, radicchio.
It can be annoying, but there is a talent to writing a menu. And certain restaurateurs and restaurants have it, and you just, again, you don't really notice it, actually. But you look, you know, you look and see, you know, what's flowery, what's overdone. There's a sameness. I mean, there is a formula to all these menus. And what you try to see is what they do with the formula, what they manage to sort of, you know, the de rigueur lamb dish or the salmon dish and how... with a fish dish or the steak dish. They're all going to have a steak dish. How do they handle it in a way that doesn't seem sort of mundane or prosaic? I tend to order things that look strange.
Do you ever, though, run into a problem where, you know, this place opened, it's been open for a month, you made your reservation a few weeks ago, you got to review it for your job, but you get there and you're like, I'm just not in the mood for this type of food tonight.
No. You have to, if you're like a professional glutton, you gotta bring your A game every night.
Right.
But you have, basically, you of course you're in the mood. It's your job.
Right.
You don't go to the office and go, well, you do actually. I'm not in the mood for this. There are times when you sort of aren't in the mood, but you have to enjoy eating. If you don't enjoy eating, you're not going to enjoy it. So I actually enjoy eating.
I want to run a couple of my ordering strategies by you and get your take.
Ordering strategies.
Yeah.
I don't know if I got the menu. What's your menu strategy?
Well, I mean, it depends on my mood. I actually really, rather than putting too much thought into reading, I try to read the item and really picture and envision myself eating it. And then I have a sort of like deliciousometer, an internal deliciousometer, and whichever right. gets the highest rating
yeah.
is the one that I would go with. Yeah. But
so you see, I don't have that anxiety because I'm going to eat the whole menu. So that's the thing. I'm not coming in there going, oh, I better be right about this. It doesn't really matter.
Right. See, I feel pressure.
I'm eating the whole menu. So it's not, I'm not ordering a meal for myself. I'll just say, you guys order whatever you want, but everybody orders something different. And I'll taste it, and I'll eat the porcupine or whatever.
Do you literally order everything?
Over a series of visits, yes.
Okay, wow. Sometimes, I'm also a big, because I have this concern about ordering badly, I'm a big negotiator with the people at my table. I'm always trying to persuade them to share things with me. I'm always bartering.
Well, you're just a pain in the butt.
That's one word for it. So, like, one thing I like to do, like, let's say there's two entrees that look great and I can't decide. Order one of them for an appetizer and share it with someone.
Good idea.
Okay.
Order them both. That's what I do.
Another approach I have, which is sort of the opposite of the entree for an appetizer, is let's say I see a lot of appetizers that look good, but no entree jumps out at me. The three appetizer approach. One appetizer for the first course and then two together for my entree.
You know, that's the old saw, right? The old saw is the entrees were good, but I got to the main courses and they were boring. So it's like, yeah, why not?
Right.
Two entrees. Hey, three sounds good.
Yeah.
Why not four?
I also like to sometimes reverse the order. I'm a proponent of entrees first and appetizers second.
That's weird.
Okay. Well, here's my logic. You tell me what you think. I think that, first of all, appetizers, judging by their name, I think were invented should just sort of be a little taste of something, and they've become a pretty substantial part of a meal. Now, if I go into a restaurant and I'm really hungry, let's say I'm going to Second Avenue Deli, which is my personal pick for the best pastrami in New York City.
Fine.
You don't have to argue with me.
It's all good. It's good.
I love their pastrami. Now, if I go in there, I'm not going to get a bowl of matzo ball soup before my pastrami. I don't want anything to get in the way.
Mm.
I don't want anything to blunt my appetite. Mm. If I see an entree on the menu that looks phenomenal and that's what I want, mm-hmm. I'm not going to have an appetizer. I'm going to go straight to the entree. Yeah. And then if I'm still hungry
mm-hmm.
and I want a little something more, if you're still really hungry, sweet is not going to satisfy you. You want something savory. Appetizer for dessert.
I see your reasoning. I mean, if you're obsessed with this certain kind of food.
If you're obsessed with deliciousness.
If you want to devour it, I see your reasoning. Okay. I mean, I don't think it necessarily works in a, you know. It's a deli. Yeah. I don't know if it works at Le Bernardin.
Yeah, I've done it at a nice restaurant. Like, for instance, I was at a nice restaurant a while back. There was a pork rib appetizer. It was delicious, but I was sharing it with other people at the table. And then I had my entree, which was also good, but not as good. And I was just left thinking, geez, I wish I could have a few more bites of that pork appetizer. And that's what I ordered for my dessert.
Yeah.
And I left happy. I was in Florence, and I once had shrimp risotto for dessert.
That's fine. I remember one of the first reviews I wrote, not the first, maybe it's the thing, you know, Daniel Boulud's famous DB Bistro burger that's mm-hmm. famous is the first oat burger to be made. What it cost $20 some. It had foie gras in the middle of it. And I went to the DB, did my review of DB, went there once, had the DB burger. I thought it was awesome. Came back the next time. I didn't want to get the DB burger because I'd already gotten it. But I was with these, you know, friends like you, these vociferous characters. And I said, man, this thing is really interesting. You guys should try it. So we had it for dessert.
That sounds nice. I think I was there in spirit.
What's your feeling about tasting menus?
I don't like them. And I'll tell you why.
Well, you got trouble today.
Yeah, I know. It's all over the place. I can't get away from it. Here's my problem with the tasting menu is that you get a little taste. First of all, there's just declining deliciousness because your palate gets overwhelmed. So there's that. But then beyond that, you're hungry, you eat the first thing, you're less hungry. You wait, you get more hungry, you eat the second thing, but it's still just a taste. So now you're less hungry. Then you wait and you get more hungry. And then you eat another thing. and then you're less hungry. And so you go back and forth between being hungry and less hungry without ever really being full per se, but yet you're somehow, your mouth still feels bored. Like you've, like your brain and your palate are full, but your stomach isn't.
Well, that's an impressive analysis. Now, I like tasting menus. I mean, it's a trend now. And
yeah, what do you think?
I don't really like them. They just take too long.
That's the other thing.
You know, they're highly full of themselves in a lot of ways.
Also, there's just this irritating sort of thing that people somehow are impressed. You know, it's as if the number of courses and the cost are a selling point. Right. It's like, it's a 27-course meal for $500. And it's like, nothing in that sentence sounded appealing to me. A couple more things I want to cover here. Becca Omars tweeted me a question for you. She wanted to know, to what degree should leftover potential be taken into account when you order?
It depends, I guess, on your appetite. I don't take it into account.
Do you bring home leftovers?
Of course.
Good.
I give them to my girls.
Okay.
They never eat them.
Really?
No. I always eat them myself the next day.
Yeah. What must your refrigerator look like? It must be a wonderland.
It gets messy, but my wife is a neatnik. So.
Okay.
But, you know, in general, leftovers, I think leftovers are fine. It's not a perfect meal if you have a lot of leftovers, really. When you come to think of
it. Interesting.
I mean, it really isn't.
Because the portions are too large?
They're too large, or you didn't eat enough, or something happened.
I think you make an interesting point that if you're constantly bringing home tons of leftovers and you're not a professional food critic, restaurant critic, then either you're going to restaurants with overly sized portions or you're ordering too much food.
Or you don't like it.
Right. But I will say in response to the question that there are times, if I go to a restaurant starving, then I'm probably going to eat everything that I receive and not have leftovers.
But, well, you certainly.
Right. But there are times that I'll go in and be, you know, maybe I'm not starving or I have decided that I want to have a beer or two and that will fill you up a little bit. And I order an entree and say, you know what, this entree looks great. I'm not really hungry enough to eat an appetizer and an entree, but I'm going to order it anyway because I'm at a restaurant and I don't get to go out to eat restaurants as much as I'd like. And I'm going to eat my appetizer and half my entree and take the other half of the entree home and eat it tomorrow.
Right.
Before I let you go, I want to, you know, this show's me for Valentine's Day, so I want to ask a bit about sharing food.
Yes.
Which certainly is something that happens at your table when you're ordering everything on the menu.
Yes.
Now, let's say people are on a date. Let's say they haven't been dating for that long. They're out on Valentine's Day or whenever. They're out to dinner together. I think that sort of whether and how they share food can be kind of awkward. It can also be kind of telling. As I see it, there are five possibilities. I want to run through all of them, and I want you to tell me what you think each one says about the sharer and the state of the relationship. Mm-hmm. On one end of the spectrum, you have a person who just says, I don't share food. You're sitting across the table from them, you're out on a date, and you say, oh my, that looks delicious. Oh, okay, great. Or, oh my, can I try some? Well, I don't share food. What does that say about that person?
I would say that is not an auspicious sign. Unless you also are one of those people, you know, obsessive, control-oriented.
Next step along the path, I think, is a person who would cut off a bite from their plate and then place it onto your plate.
How do you define bite?
Like they cut off one.
I think that's nice.
Okay. What about they hand you their plate and let you cut off your own portion?
Fine. I don't like the whole handing plates thing.
Right.
I like the nice forkful here, honey. This is beautiful. Taste this. I love this. You try it.
But then as we move, you know, in the direction of a more intimate approach, I can cut off a piece. I have now a piece of steak on my fork to share with you. I could take it off my fork and place it on your plate, or I could just hand you my fork with the bite on it.
I think just take it off, put it on the plate.
Okay, but like when you're out with your wife.
That's what we do.
She she just puts it on your plate?
Yeah.
You don't swap forks?
No, well, sometimes, you know, it depends. But generally, you know, we do some plate swapping. But generally, here, try this. You know, I have a whole system.
Tell me about it.
Well, it's not really a system. But because your people are saying, because you're supposed to taste all this food, so you have a little... Often two, the little bread plates on the side. And so they'll just put them on there.
With the bread plates, when people are passing you their taste, do you get worried about like sauce touching? Do you try to keep areas of the plate clean?
No, God, come on. Come on.
But there is one more, even more seductive way to share food, Adam, and that is to feed the bite to someone else.
It's beautiful. I'm all in favor of it. I think the ideal, actually, I think the ideal, Valentine's, is to share a dish together. So you have a communal experience, and then you share a nice bottle of wine or a nice bottle of bourbon, and it's all good. So I think that's sort of the ideal of Valentine. I'd go for that.
Adam Platt, New York Magazine restaurant critic. People can find you on Twitter at PlattyPants. Is that right?
Yeah, PlattyPants.
Also, always writing in New York Magazine. People should, of course, also check out Grub Street blog, which is New York Magazine's food and restaurant blog, which has a lot of great work. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
That does it for this show, friends. Thanks so much for tuning in. Remember to connect with The Sporkful on Facebook, facebook.com/Sporkful, on Twitter, at The Sporkful. Of course, you can always check out the website, Sporkful.com. Also, a lot of videos there from my new cooking channel web series, You're Eating It Wrong. So go to Sporkful.com and watch those. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.